From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's program, Iran's message to the world.
Nuclear energy is about securing the future of our children, about diversifying our economy, about stopping the burning of our oil, and about generating clean power.
Iran's foreign minister posting his speech on YouTube ahead of international talks in Geneva over his nation's controversial nuclear aspirations. We're on Capitol Hill, where next year's defense bill comes under fierce debate. Also today, we go to Russia for the latest on the plight of the detained Greenpeace activists. And we follow the illegal international ivory trade all the way to Colorado.
You can argue about the statistic of how many elephants are left in the world, but when you do the math, if we continue on the path today, all of those elephants will die within a 10-year period.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. French police are holding a man in custody in connection with the media shootings in Paris on Monday. Authorities say he bears a strong physical resemblance to the suspect, and they're testing his DNA for a match. Kate Moody reports from Paris.
The man was arrested in an underground parking lot in a western suburb just outside the French capital. He was apparently found unconscious after ingesting a large quantity of drugs and was taken to the hospital before being questioned. He's believed to have critically injured a photographer after opening fire in the lobby of the Libération newspaper on Monday morning, then of firing shots outside a Société Générale bank in the La Défense business district, and then of hijacking a car and forcing the driver to take him to the Champs-Élysées. The same suspect is also thought to have threatened a 24-hour news channel last week. French police had received thousands of calls since launching a public appeal for information on Monday, and it was one of those tip-offs that apparently led to the arrest.
The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he and the Afghan President Hamid Karzai have agreed on a bilateral security pact. The deal will govern the presence of U.S. forces in Afghanistan after the NATO combat mission ends next year. Kate Fisher has more.
The document still needs to gain the approval of a council of Afghan elders at a meeting tomorrow. The group of 3,000 can revise or reject any clause of the draft agreement. A flat-out rejection could prevent the Afghan government from signing it altogether. It had been reported that President Karzai had demanded an apology from the US for civilian casualties, but John Kerry said this was not true. Kate Fisher, Washington.
Negotiators from six world powers are hoping to reach an agreement with Iran on its nuclear program at a meeting in Geneva. The initial deal would mean loosening some sanctions and is opposed by the Israeli government and several senior U.S. lawmakers. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The Geneva talks within the P5+1 international structure represent a new attempt to reach a deal after the last-minute breakdown of negotiations 2 weeks ago. The deal, which some U.S. officials say is close, will involve Iran slowing its nuclear enrichment activities in exchange for a loosening of sanctions, with the goal of reaching a comprehensive agreement within 6 months. As the talks resume, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei said in a speech that Iran would not stop nuclear enrichment and called Israel's leadership untouchable rabid dogs. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is calling it an extraordinarily bad deal, and despite several U.S. lawmakers agreeing with him, Congress is for the moment holding back on imposing any new sanctions on Iran.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The hearings of the arrested Greenpeace activists continue for a third consecutive day in the courts of St. Petersburg, Russia. Initially, the prosecutors demanded all of the detainees to be held under arrest until February, but 10 Arctic Sunrise crew members were released on bail earlier this week. One Australian activist was denied bail, however, and is to remain in custody until February 24th. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
The cases of the arrested Greenpeace activists accused of hooliganism are heard by two courts in St. Petersburg. The 60-year-old captain of Arctic Sunrise vessel, American Peter Wilcox, was first to appear in the Kalininsky court. The U.S. consular in St. Petersburg also attended the detention hearing to support the bail appeal. The U.K. activist Alexander Harris told media as she was led into the courtroom in the Primorsky court that she felt, quote, trapped inside a political game. The cases of five more Arctic Sunrise crew members, the Dutch activists Faiza Ulliksen and Manas Ubels, and Jensen from Denmark, as well as Britain's Kieran Bryan and Anthony Parrott, are expected to be heard on Wednesday.
And a neo-Nazi serial killer has been executed in the U.S. state of Missouri. Joseph Franklin targeted Jewish and black people and was convicted of 8 racially motivated murders, although he may have carried out more. Nick Harper reports.
Between 1977 and 1980, Joseph Franklin crisscrossed America, picking out Jews and African Americans, using a sniper rifle to kill them. The 63-year-old was convicted of 8 murders, but claimed to have carried out more than 20. He said he did it to start a race war, after reading Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. His crimes included the murder of a man leaving a bar mitzvah, 2 black teenagers in Ohio, an interracial couple in Wisconsin, and 2 black joggers in Utah. One of the people he shot, hustler publisher and anti-death penalty campaigner Larry Flint, had tried to prevent Franklin's execution.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
For us Iranians, nuclear energy is not about joining a club or threatening others. Nuclear energy is about a leap, a jump toward deciding our own destiny. For us, nuclear energy is about securing the future of our children, about diversifying our economy, about stopping the burning of our oil, and about generating clean power.
Iran's silver-tongued Foreign Minister Javad Zarif speaking in a video released on his personal YouTube channel earlier today. Iranians couldn't see it. YouTube is blocked by their government. Iran's negotiators are back in Geneva, sitting down with representatives from the US and 5 other nations, trying to strike a deal with Tehran over the country's nuclear aspirations. Also today, Iran's supreme leader struck a different note. He said the country will not step back one iota as the talks resume, and said red lines over Iran's right to rich uranium must be observed by the country's negotiators. FSN's Simon Marks spoke to Laura Rosen of the news website Al Monitor. She's in Geneva covering the talks and says she doesn't believe the country's supreme leader is trying to torpedo a deal.
You know, he's saying a lot of things that he said previously in terms of, you know, saying on the one hand he wants friendly relations with the United States and other countries, but giving a long list of reasons why he thinks it's the other countries' responsibilities to change their behavior. So I'm not sure I take it as an intervention.
His intervention notwithstanding, what calculations are the various sides making as they go into these discussions?
So they came, if you listen to all sides, they came quite close at the last meeting about 10 days ago to getting an agreement. They essentially, the 6 countries in the West, in Russia and China, got their consensus position, gave it to the Iranian negotiator Zarif, and he took it back. There's been a lot of signaling the past few days from Iran, including what you mentioned from the Supreme Leader, asserting their rights to enrich, about the language that may be in this accord, under which in an end-state deal, Iran could still have some enrichment for energy uses. What the U.S. has been saying is we don't recognize any country's right to enrich, but they're not rejecting that in practice Iran could in practice have enrichment. Does that make sense? It's not about rights for the U.S. It's about the fact of it. And I've seen a lot of signaling from Zarif, who uses Twitter, as you have seen, also mentioning we don't care if other countries recognize our rights. We know it's our right. They just want to make sure that in the end they can enrich.
Do you see any sign of pressure on Secretary of State John Kerry, given that the Republicans yesterday indicated they won't put new sanctions against Tehran to a vote until after the Thanksgiving holiday? But let's be honest, the Thanksgiving holiday is right round the corner.
You know, there's just this new poll I was just looking at by the Washington Post and ABC News. It really shows, you know, 64% of the public, a very large majority, support the deal on the table that would offer Iran some limited sanctions relief for these concessions. Only 30% opposed. That's pretty strongly in favor of what the U.S. has been arguing for. I think the fact that Congress has held off through 2 meetings on new sanctions, despite some noises, is a sign that they're essentially going with this. They are giving it room. And then, you know, after Thanksgiving, we only have a week or so to get through before they break for the year. So I think if things are moving along, if the U.S. comes back and says either that they have a deal or that they're very close and quite encouraged, I think Congress is probably liable to give them a bit of space. I will say there was an awful lot of diplomatic security when I arrived with the U.S. team from Washington today, more than usually come for political directors meetings. And I took it as a sign that the foreign ministers in Kerry are keeping open the option to come on Friday to sign something.
Now, but there have been those who say that if it doesn't get done in this round of talks in Geneva, it won't get done. It doesn't sound like you necessarily share that view.
I mean, I'm hoping it gets done. I think that they felt like, you know, you've seen lots of signaling from both sides that they think they're very close. And it's hard to keep the momentum and the space alive every time. But honestly, they've said that for the last several talks. So, and here we are.
And just finally, people who don't want this to get done, of course, include Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel. Any indication that he's in any position to head this off?
I think they've accepted they're not going to head this off this week. I think they accept this is going to happen, and he's staked out what he's essentially done is staked out a position that he does not accept this. This leaves perhaps his options open in 3-4 months if he wants to spoil a deal, or if he sees backtracking or move militarily even. So he's just staking out the position that he is not accepting this deal.
Laura Rosen for AlMonitor.com in Geneva.
Facing a long list of deadlines and obligations, the US Senate is scrambling to finish the bill that sets the funding and policy for the military before the end of the year. This week, lawmakers are debating controversial amendments on military sexual assault, economic sanctions on Iran, and the Guantanamo Bay prison. But some lawmakers and independent watchdogs are urging a closer look at the underlying bill, in which the senators ignore the budget caps they themselves set 2 years ago. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein reports.
In an environment of fiscal austerity, in which social safety net programs like food stamps and Head Start preschool face deep cuts, the Senate continued debate this week on a bill to authorize more than $600 billion for the military to use in 2014. Policy watchdogs, including Ethan Rosencrantz with the Project on Government Oversight, have pointed to many areas where lawmakers are set to spend more money than military leaders say they need.
The Pentagon has put forth a number of modest proposals for ways to save money, and Congress has, by and large, rejected those proposals.
The Senate defense bill would give the military about $1.3 billion that the Pentagon has not requested, for everything from weapons and aircraft to discredited and canceled programs like the Human Terrain System, which sent anthropologists into combat zones in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2007. The massive funding bill also does little to combat the pervasive problem of private military contractors overcharging the government for their services or committing outright fraud, which has been documented by government investigations and outside groups. Rosencrantz says the powerful military-industrial complex deserves credit for this lack of cuts and reforms.
There's intense lobbying. There's intense campaign contributions. Frankly, these contractors routinely brag about how they're able to spread these projects out over as many districts and states as possible.
But you won't hear much discussion of these spending decisions in this week's debate on the defense bill. The Senate has mostly focused on a handful of controversial amendments. On Tuesday night, the Senate voted down one measure that would have blocked President Obama from transferring Guantanamo Bay prisoners to the United States for detention, trial, or medical treatment, which many see as a crucial step towards closing the facility. On Wednesday, lawmakers took up the Military Justice Improvement Act, an amendment to the defense bill that would change the way the armed forces handle rape and sexual assault. Currently, a survivor of rape or assault has to report the crime to his or her commander, who holds the power to decide whether to investigate it or ignore it. The amendment's author is New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand.
We believe that the decision to prosecute serious crimes, including sexual assault, should be made by trained legal professionals who are outside the chain of command, but still within the military. This change will allow prosecutorial decisions to be made based on facts and evidence and not derailed by pre-existing relationships, attitudes, biases, and perceptions.
All this week, veteran survivors of sexual assault from across the country have come to D.C. to lobby undecided senators, sharing their stories and urging them to support the Gillibrand Amendment. One of them is Kate Weber, who was raped by a high-ranking officer when she was 18 years old and stationed in Nuremberg, Germany. In a press conference on Capitol Hill this week, she said the military failed to provide her adequate care or accountability.
When I told my supervisors, they simply suggested I get a checkup. I went to the hospital where I was examined by an 06, a lieutenant colonel. He noted there was bruising on my cervix, but didn't conduct a rape kit. When I got back to my barracks that night, I found my rapist there waiting for me. He grabbed me by my neck and threatened me, saying he had a pregnant wife. Although I reported my rape to multiple superiors in my chain of command, they each chose to help cover up the crime instead of initiating an investigation.
More than 50 senators, Republicans and Democrats, have voiced support for the Military Justice Improvement Act, but it may not have the votes to overcome a potential filibuster. Meanwhile, a group of senators continues to push party leaders to allow a vote on an amendment to increase economic sanctions on Iran. The White House has been asking Congress to hold off on such votes, as U.S. and Iranian negotiators are in Geneva right now on the brink of a major agreement on Iran's nuclear program. The administration worries new sanctions could derail the sensitive talks. But some lawmakers, including Alabama Republican Richard Shelby, disagree.
I think they're wrong. Because sanctions, if something's working, you keep it up. And this is short of war. This is short of the threat of war.
With more than 50 amendments filed to the massive bill, it's unlikely the Senate will finish its work before leaving for Thanksgiving break, leaving very little time after that to negotiate with the House on a final version before current funding expires. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now to Russia, where reports say a number of Greenpeace activists have been granted bail by courts in St. Petersburg. But one Australian activist from the so-called Arctic 30 has been denied bail. This follows 2 months spent in bleak and freezing detention camps, suffering what the group called severe abuses of their human rights. Our Moscow correspondent Tom Barton has the story.
Each nervous detainee is pushed inside a human-sized cage in the courtroom and forced to ask the Russian judge for their freedom, even though they consider themselves the ones mistreated. The radio operator on board Greenpeace's Arctic Sunrise, Australian Colin Russell, is being forced to stay in prison, possibly for months. He says all on board the boat had their human rights trampled on.
They forcefully took our vessel and pointed guns at us and forced us into one room on the vessel. They did not identify themselves at any time. They cut all our communications so we could not make a phone call to our lawyers. It was some 112 hours before we were accused of anything. So I say that my human rights have been violated very, very wrongly and badly.
The activists had been protesting Russian state energy giant Gazprom's first attempt to drill for oil under Arctic seas, which they consider an environmental disaster waiting to happen. After their seizure, they described being confined 23 hours a day in freezing cells in the northern Russian port of Murmansk. Another activist, Britain Alexandra Harris, says she was kept in appalling conditions by Russian authorities.
They were awful. It was cold. It was disgusting. But the conditions are better now in St. Petersburg, but it's still prison, I'm still trapped, it's still can't speak to anyone, cut off from the world, it's nerve-wracking.
Governments and protesters around the world are outraged by their treatment, the charges of hooliganism against them, and consider their seizure illegal as the ship was in international waters. When it came to the charges against them, Colin Russell was equally disgusted with what he considers a Soviet-style show trial.
I haven't done anything wrong. I don't understand the reasons why I'm being detained. I've done 2 months of hard time for nothing. I've done nothing wrong. That's why I disagree. I haven't committed a crime, so I have nothing to run from.
British journalist Kieran Byron was covering the protest but not involved in it. He too pointed out what he sees as the absurdity of Russian prosecutors' arguments.
To be accused of hooliganism, doing my job as a reporter, is the same as suggesting that every journalist who works in a war zone is a soldier, or that the court reporter here today is somehow responsible for the outcome.
Most of the now famous Arctic 30 are being granted bail, albeit at a rate of $61,000 each. But despite demands around the world for their release, it's unlikely they will be allowed to leave the country yet, as a possible 7 years in one of Russia's notoriously brutal prison colonies could await each of them. Tom Barton, Moscow.
Empowering women. That's the slogan of India's new bank, exclusively for women. The bank in New Delhi says the initiative is trying to give millions of women financial independence and security. The project, which will be largely run by women, comes at a time when women's rights are high on the nation's agenda, especially with the widely reported cases of sexual violence across the country. Nearly 25,000 cases of rape were reported alone last year. Earlier, I asked the South Asia director for Human Rights Watch in Bombay, Meenakshi Ganguly, how important economic empowerment was for the nation's female population.
Largely because it's still a traditional society where finances are handled by the men of the house. Women very rarely handle money and therefore do not even know how to maneuver the entire system. So the logic would have been that, you know, you create a comfort zone, so it's a women-only place, and encouraging women to handle finances and eventually, I suppose, build towards financial independence.
If this bank offers women greater financial freedom and security, is it just part of a wider social change in terms of India's infrastructure and their cultural attitudes towards women?
We have to understand whether the state recognises and respects women-headed households, because almost all documentation is still done through the men of the house. So it passes from father to son. So if there's a widow who owns the house, it often still is the son that is listed. So in terms of property, in terms of finances, the authority is vested in the male. And that attitude would need to shift, which would be much more important than creating a bank, which is a good idea, but still seems a bit symbolic.
Is it suggestive of a wider-ranging, progressive moves in Indian society, especially concerning the rights of women? Something that's been widely documented is the alarming number of sexual assault offences over 2012 and into 2013.
The incident in December set off a very significant number of protests in India. It was middle-class India coming out on the streets, which doesn't happen often, demanding better protection for women. And that led to pushing through a new, much more stringent law to protect women from sexual abuse. Now, those have been good steps. The government actually was able to put in fairly good language. It's a piece of legislation that has been welcomed. But legislation in itself is just a piece of law. It needs to be properly implemented. And for that, there needs to be systemic change, primarily creating safer spaces for women, not secluding them. And that's partly why my discomfort with this bank, because it once again removes women from the mainstream. Well, the idea is that the mainstream should be where a woman should belong and be feel perfectly safe in. And in that same context, we hope that the Indian government will proceed towards training its police force, making it much more accountable, ensuring that women are safe. India is also a society in transition, so there are a lot more women in the workforce, a lot more women out. The younger generation now are women that go to colleges, they want jobs, they take jobs, they get jobs, they are working mothers. Now, but once the society changes, where there are more women in the workforce, systems have to be put into place to support that, including facilities for proper childcare, support of elderly parents, all the sort of things that traditionally women took care of. Now there will need to be support structures to take care of those.
Meenakshi Ganguly in Bombay. Have you ever wondered what happens to illegal goods after they're confiscated? In the case of ivory confiscated here in the United States, it's sent to a depository in Colorado, where a massive supply has built up over the past two decades. In an effort to raise awareness of damage that the illegal ivory trade is inflicting on elephants, especially in Africa, US officials hosted a massive crushing of the ivory. FSN's Denver correspondent Mary McCarthy sent us this report.
Ornately carved tusks, walking canes, and statues. Ornaments that look like they belong in an elegant living room. But they're here to be smashed into tiny bits at an ivory crush hosted by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
What you see here is a fraction of the worldwide traffic, illegal traffic, in ivory.
6 tons of ivory are being pulverized by a giant steel crusher. This comes at a time when global demand for the precious material is soaring. Crushing is used because ivory is highly resistant to fire. The ivory trade was banned by an international treaty in 1989, but that hasn't stopped demand getting so high that the elephant population is on the brink of extinction, according to Azzedine Downs of the International Fund for Animal Welfare.
You can argue about the statistic of how many elephants are left in the world, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000. But when you do the math, if we continue on the path today, all of those elephants will die within a 10-year period.
These days, the biggest market for ivory by far is Asia. China allows the sale of what's called pre-prohibition ivory, that which was harvested before the 1989 ban. But, says Paula Kahumbu of the Kenya Land Conservation Trust, a large illegal market still exists there.
China probably consumes between 70 and 90% of the world's ivory. That means that they are necessarily a part of the solution. Because in one act, if they ban domestic trade in ivory, that would dry up 70 to 90% of the demand. Prices of ivory would collapse.
I know. I have been doing...
Hollywood stars came to the ivory crush to show their support for elephant conservation.
I'm sorry, I'm probably going to cry.
That included Kristen Davis, best known as Charlotte on the hit television show Sex and the City.
Americans believe that other people in other countries are the only people buying ivory, which is not the case. We are the second biggest market for illegal wildlife trade. That is huge. So if we can stop the demand here, first of all, it's going to really lessen the demand in the world, but also we're leading through example.
Most experts agree that events like this are very effective at raising awareness. But, says conservationist Jim Nyamu of the Elephant Neighbors Center, the best way to stop the killing of elephants is to educate the people who poach them.
I wish today we could have just gotten few poachers, whatever they are, to come and witness and see the byproduct of what comes after the ivory, because there is a disconnect between them killing elephants and what comes after the ivory.
This is the first time U.S. officials have destroyed such a large supply of ivory. It's part of a new push to halt wildlife trafficking announced by President Obama during his tour of Africa last summer. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Thursday, the pastor suspended for officiating his son's same-sex marriage. That's Thursday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.